Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by 1-800-DIAL-DJs.com. If you need live entertainment for your party, wedding, bar mitzvah, or corporate event in the New York, New Jersey, or Philadelphia metro areas, check out 1-800-DIAL-DJs.com for a real good time. So where was I before the commercial? Oh, yeah. Mr. Media is recorded live from the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. There's been a lot of whining in recent years about the fate of the physical book, and for that matter, magazines and newspapers in general. We're in an era of rapidly shifting habits, spending more time, effort, and money on the digital word over its print cousin. And yet there are some happy hangers-on to the old ways and old days. Nicholas Spice, the publisher of the London Review of Books, for example, is about to join me to say that his publication's numbers are up. Not just on the web, but in the Dead Trees edition, too. Incidentally, the London Review of Books, which you can preview online at www.lrb.co.uk, is celebrating the 30th anniversary of its U.S. edition this month, April 2010. Nicholas, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hello there.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. I'm having a great time. It's a wonderful day.
You know, I was going to say I would have been so disappointed if you didn't bring a bit of London to this interview in the way you spoke. I'm so relieved that you do.
Well, it was lucky that I managed to get here at all, since most of London is obviously, you know, unable to get out because of the volcano.
I understand your editor is stranded somewhere.
Yeah, she's trying to get a plane, but we don't know whether she'll make it. But I'm here, so that's fine.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And Nicholas, for those who know nothing about the London Review of Books but only tune in for the sound of my voice, can you tell them a little bit about your publication?
Yes, the London Review of Books was launched 30 years ago by the New York Review of Books, believe it or not. They launched a UK edition of the New York Review, which they published as an insert in the New York Review for about 6 months, but it was didn't really work out commercially, so they bowed out after 6 months, and the London Review of Books became an independent, you know, book criticism journal in May 1980, which is why we're celebrating the 30th anniversary this week. The thing is that it's a journal that publishes long book reviews, really very long book reviews, sometimes as much as 5,000 or 6,000 words long, about new books. This is really a kind of 19th century model in a sense, but it's done very well in the 20th century, and we've found plenty of readers. Our circulation is growing, and we fully expect that in the digital age we will be able to adapt.
Why? Now, I barely have time these days to read books, let alone a book review that's like a short novella. What sustained that interest over the years? Aren't you guys suffering from the same thing that everyone else is, short attention spans, that kind of thing?
Well, I think, you know, quite often too much is made about this business of attention spans. These are the kind of things that are said without very much statistical backup. I think that when media change, so in other words, when you move from reading a book to reading a magazine, when you read from reading a magazine, you move from reading a magazine to looking at text on a screen or on an e-reader, the kind of attention you pay changes. That happens inevitably because you're absorbing the text in a different way. Now, if you read a London Review of Books article, which seems very, very long in a magazine that you're reading over breakfast, say, you're in a different attention frame of mind, so it will seem very long to you. If you come across that article in a book, it'll seem very short because it'll only be about 6 pages long, and you'll think, well, that's very short because your attention span is different. And I think that's when we're talking about attention span, this is what we've got to bear in mind. It's the context that you read in that determines attention, not some wider cultural degradation.
Well, what take us through a recent issue and some of the books that would get have gotten that kind of lengthy review coverage, because I'm sure it wouldn't work for every book.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the kinds of things that we review are, we always have reviews of contemporary literary novels. That's something we do. We review books on politics and current affairs, but, you know, big issues. We had a review recently of a book by Gary Wills, for example, about the way in which America's exercise of power, and especially the exercise of power by the president, has been determined by the fact that he has control over nuclear weapons. Now, that's quite a complex subject. It can't be dealt with adequately in a short newspaper article. It needs a long essay. And a lot of the stuff that we publish stands up in its own right. I mean, the reason people read this magazine, if they read it, is because they find these articles interesting for themselves. It's not just a way of finding out whether there are books you want to buy. It's not that kind of magazine. It's there to give interesting conversation, discussion, argument about complex issues of the day, whether to do with books or whether to do with politics or history or anything else.
Now, I understand you've been with the review almost since the beginning, if not the beginning. How has it changed over time?
Well, it started out as a very, very small operation. I mean, it still is, relatively speaking, small, but when I first started there in 1982, there were only about 8 people working on the magazine, and it had about 5,000 readers. Mm-hmm. Now we have, I think, 45 members of staff. Our circulation is over 50,000. We're the biggest literary magazine in Europe, because, of course, the market is rather different there than in the States. We've opened a retail bookshop, which has been very successful, and we've recently opened a cafe next to the bookshop. And we've developed a couple of really quite successful websites alongside that, too. So the operations become much more complicated, much more interesting, much more challenging. And I think, above all, we're really, really excited and challenged by the prospects of adapting this kind of publishing to a digital age.
I want to ask you, you mentioned that readership is very different in Europe. And I'm more inclined to believe, and maybe it's a prejudice of my own, that a UK or a European reader would be more inclined to these longer essays about books than an American reader.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I really don't think so. I mean, you've got to remember, the New York Review of Books is a terrific magazine, and it has a great circulation here in the US, and it actually launched the London Review of Books. It came out of an American business. And I think there's a tremendous tradition of reading in the States. I don't think that you can make that kind of comparison. Almost half our readers are in the U.S. We've got 20,000 readers in the U.S., which, you know, is pretty good, really, for a U.K. magazine. That's partly because we cover quite a lot of American subjects. We have quite a lot of American writers, American advertisers. I wouldn't go along with that. No, I wouldn't do that.
Okay. Is it a different edition that publishes in the U.S. versus the U.K.?
No, it's exactly the same, but we market it differently here. We print in the U.S. because the way in which we market the magazine requires that we have copies quickly with the readers, and it's also very expensive to ship copies from the U.K. on a fortnightly basis. So in terms of business model and economics, we print here, we market here, but the actual publication is the same.
Is the London Review competitive with the New York Review at this point?
Yeah, I suppose we're always sort of competitive in a friendly way. But I think, you know, when people talk about competition in the media market, you have to be very careful. One of the worst things that can happen to a magazine is for its competitors to become weak. Because if its competitors start to go into decline, the overall pool of readers for that kind of thing starts to shrink. People go back into the woodwork. If you don't have other lists to mail, other websites to go to, other magazines to advertise in, you can't reach your potential readers. So competitors, strong competitors, are very important to success in a magazine. I mean, it's like opening a drugstore in a street full of drugstores. It's that kind of rule. On the other hand, we do compete with the New York Review of Books, the Times Literary Supplement, the New York Times Book Review, and so on, the Guardian, for writers. I think there is competition for writers, but not for readers. The more competition there is, the better it is for readership.
And what about stylistically? How can you point a finger and say this is This is how the London Review is different stylistically from the New York Review or the Guardian or the New York Times Sunday.
Yeah, I think there's a sense. There are two things to be said here. One of them is that the New York Review of Books, New York Times Book Review, are publications coming out of the, you know, the richest country in the world, the most powerful country in the world, a country that has an empire. So a country that's broadly similar to Britain 100 years ago. Now, that changes the way in which you write. I think you have to be more direct. You have to be more public. You have to be a little bit more straight-faced about dealing with subjects. And you have to be, if you are not quite at the center stage politically, as Britain no longer is center stage. And I think the thing about the London Review of Books, it has a little bit more freedom with style to be slightly more experimental, slightly more frivolous, slightly more interested in wit and the oblique, the slightly indirect approach to a subject. It can be more, you know, it can be slightly more quirky about the subjects it chooses and the way it allows its writers to write about them. So I think you'd find it a little bit more playful. That would be.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you.
No, that's fine. No.
Have there been any major controversies as a result of pieces in the review?
Well, I think the main area of controversy for us is the Middle East. We have consistently run articles mainly by dissident Israeli intellectuals about the Israel-Palestine situation. We sit on the left in that debate, and as I said, we have some very distinguished Israeli writers who write about that for us, but they are not popular in Israel, or indeed particularly popular with Americans who have an unwavering support for Israel under all conditions. The other thing is we did run a piece which was extremely controversial about 3 years ago by, you've probably heard about this, two American academics called Mearsheimer and Walt, who are writing about the influence of IPAC on American foreign policy. Now, that did cause an enormous amount of interest and a lot of controversy, which is still reverberating.
Let's come around to what I mentioned in the introduction. Has the review adapted its business model in recent years to the digital world, or have you made the digital world bend to you?
No, I think we are trying to bend to it. I mean, the thing about the London Review of Books at the moment is that we've been through a period of great expansion. We've been very successful on the traditional business model. We've expanded our circulation through subscription marketing up to pretty much the limit of what the market will give us. We are therefore very excited by what the web offers in the way of opportunity, because it opens up the market in a huge way. The big problem with it is, of course, you know, how to market to that particular marketplace, and we haven't learned that yet. What we've done so far is to prepare the ground. We've digitized the whole of our content going back to 79. So we've got 12,000 articles now on the web that you can read. Mm-hmm. We have relaunched our website to make it fit for purpose. We've built up a really good web team back at the office, and we're looking for a web marketing manager at the moment. And we're about to, as it were, begin the process of learning how to develop a coherent business model for this marketplace. We know the terminology. We know about search engine optimization, about sponsored links, about affiliation marketing, and so on and so forth. But these are just words. We haven't yet any experience in this, but we certainly intend to find it.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that while you're drawing a lot of eyes, you haven't figured out how to monetize it the way you'd like to.
No, we haven't yet. I mean, we've got one small card up our sleeve, which could be very useful to us in the long term, which is that we're able to sell relatively high priced, compared to individual subscriptions, online subscriptions to university libraries. Those are intranet subscriptions. And that will provide a steady growth in revenue through the web over the next few years. We will eventually develop, I'm quite sure, online-only subscriptions for the magazine and various, as it were, graduated engagement paywalls, all that stuff, you know, that everybody's planning to do. And I think we will do that. And I think we'll be successful with that because our content is not ephemeral. I mean, it's stuff that the people who want to read it really want to read, and they can't get it anywhere else. So I think we won't have much trouble with charging for content in due course. The real problem with that, however, is going to be developing the technology, you know, the back end, to make that kind of, you know, graduated engagement purchasing possible.
And I've got the site in front of me. Let me repeat the URL. That's the web address for those of you who don't know. If you want to check out the London Review of Books, it's www.lrb.co, not .com, but .co.uk. And tell us a little bit about how this is set up. So as I'm seeing it, the latest reviews seem to be up and available on the web for viewing, but if you want to look at the archive, you have to either be a subscriber or pay, or how does that work exactly?
Well, for ever since we had a website, which is well over 10 years ago now, we have been making 3 or 4 articles from each edition free on the web, and that's accumulated. So that free content, which is now several hundred articles, many hundred articles, is all free for anybody to read. If you want to read other articles that are closed off to everybody but print subscribers, then you have to take out a print subscription. So this is a pretty cautious and conservative model at the moment. In order just to see how things pan out, we were careful not to undermine the print subscriber base, because that's where we get our money, by opening the whole thing out to everybody, or indeed by selling online-only subscriptions. But we will inevitably move into that area. But at the moment, it's partially free, but mostly only viewable by print subscribers.
So it's like the joke about the heroin goes. You give them just a little taste to get them hooked, and hope to, you know, you give them that free taste, and then hope to bring them back in with the money.
Yeah. Let's hope so, anyway. Yeah.
Not that. Well, I guess you would like to say that the product is addictive, but not.
Well, I think it is in a sort of very peculiar and mild way. It probably is addictive, but you know, there are some very funny people out there.
And I'm looking, and I'm looking at the front page. There's very familiar names on here. Current piece, Julian Barnes, and then going back to February 19th, 1998, there's a link to Christopher Hitchens' page.
Yes, indeed. We had a rather sort of, I don't know, interesting history to our relationship with Christopher.
I think everyone has a rather interesting history to their relationship with Christopher Hitchens.
Well, he was a fantastic writer. I mean, really terrific, and he wrote some really wonderful things for us. But our views diverged on a few things, and it wasn't my decision, but I think the editors felt that, you know, it hadn't exactly fallen out, but it had become a little too wide, that difference.
Who are the superstars in the review, the people that your readers come back for every month?
I think the thing is we don't have all that many writers who are household names to the, you know, the mass public. I mean, in the UK, our most famous writer is Alan Bennett, who is a playwright and short story writer and actor, in fact. And he's a really, really much loved and famous figure in the UK. And he writes for the London Review of Books mainly in the new year. He publishes his annual diary there, which is extremely entertaining and interesting. And he's our most famous writer in the UK. Then we have a number of novelists. You know, John Lanchester, Andrew O'Hagan, Hilary Mantel, who just won the Booker Prize, Anne Enright, who won the Booker Prize the previous year or the year before that. Colm Tóibín, a range of British novelists who have a pretty high reputation, and I think a growing reputation over here. I know that Colm Tóibín has just published his latest novel, Brooklyn, here, and has got quite a reputation. So these novelists, I guess Jenny Diskey too, they wouldn't be household names here. There are some famous academics like Frank Kermode, literary critic Perry Anderson, and so on. But it's a particular world. I think if you were to ask people in the New York literary scene, they would know these people. But if you were to move outside that in the U.S., you would rapidly run out of people who recognize these names. But you might also in the U.K.
Fair enough. And I noticed that among the writer's name was a byline, Nicholas Spice.
Ah, yeah, yes. Well, you mean, do I write for the magazine?
Yes, I see that you do.
Yeah, well, over the years, I've occasionally contributed articles on fiction and sometimes on music, and I'm afraid this happens less and less. I find it really very difficult to do. It's actually very hard, and until you've actually tried to do one of these things, it's quite hard to believe how difficult it is to write an entertaining long piece like this about a book, especially aimed at people whose attention span, as I said, is going to be slightly less patient than it would be if they were reading a book. In fact, I know one LRB writer who said to me that writing an LRB review gives you cancer, so there you go.
Oh, my God!
Well, the standard is high. The editing is very, very good. The editors are very demanding. And there's a real peer pressure in this world. You know, the stakes get built up. You know who's going to be reading it, and that can put the fear of God into you, really.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, I make my living writing books, often as a co-author with other people, and I can't imagine writing a 10 or 14,000 word book review. I'd rather sit down and write a 100,000-word book. It's
yeah.
less daunting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a sort of, the thing is, it's a little bit like Netsuke or something. I mean, it's a little miniature art form, which has been going since the 17th century, this idea of writing essays. It's a genre in itself. It has its own laws, its own rules, and it's very different from writing a book. It has to be more compressed, but it also has to be more ephemeral, really. It suggests things, it sends out feelers and directions, but it doesn't have that kind of slow gravitas of the book, but it has its own problems.
Petticoats and hoop skirts and wearing multiple pounds of underwear was once in fashion for the ladies, but they stopped doing that.
Yes.
So this is, you know.
Well, this is, you... yeah.
Go ahead.
This is more like 20th century underwear, I'd say.
I was going to ask, when you do review, you know, there's so many books out there. You personally, how do you choose? Do you go with things that you're interested in, or?
I don't personally have much to do with this. I've been notably unsuccessful over the years. The only area in which I've been asked to try and find writers is for music, classical music books, and I've been a very all the people I commissioned tend not to work out. So I don't get given much of this to do, quite rightly. And the editors, this is the editorial department's job. And I think that the thing is that, as with all publishing companies, editors play to their strengths. That's what gives individuality to a publishing house, to a magazine, is that the editors don't try and be everything to everybody. They don't try and do everything. So they look at what interests them. They look at the books that seem to them to pose important questions, and also they look at books where they haven't covered that subject in recent times. I mean, what we don't do, because we're writing at such length, is to cover the same subject more than once every couple of years, really, because or a sort of related subject, because the readers don't like that. They've already read this thing, so they don't want to read another article on that. So that will act as a selecting factor. The other thing is, who is it who can write? Who have we got who can write about this subject? It's very, very important that you have somebody who can do that. And if you don't, then you don't want, you know, a limp article on an important subject. I mean, you try as far as possible to find somebody to do this, but certainly where it's, you know, not politics, where it's not absolutely vital that you run a piece, if you haven't got a really good writer, you probably let it go. And in any case, as you say, there are so many books, you know, in line to get into the magazine.
Well, I wanted to – you mentioned about editors. Your editor, Mary Kay Wilmer, has a new book out, which I think, in fairness, maybe we should mention. Is it The Eitingens?
It's called The Eitingens, yes. This is a wonderful book, I have to say. I mean, I really do think so. If you're reading the book that your editor has written, it's always a bit dangerous. You think, heavens, supposing I don't like this book, what will I say? It's very difficult to pretend to like a book. The fact is, there was no problem about liking this book. It's an absolutely terrific book. Very, very interesting take on 20th century history through the lives of three of her relatives, three uncles and distant uncles, who were operating big time in the early 20th century. I mean, fascinating stuff.
Well, did I understand this correctly, that her uncle drove the getaway car for Trotsky's assassin?
Well, no, he was the guy who was the brains behind the whole thing. He was the operator. He was the guy who set the whole thing up for Stalin. I mean, it wasn't her uncle. It's a more distant relation than that. Okay. But really a fascinating figure called Leonid Eitingen, who even survived the Stalinist purges, really on the basis of the fact that he had arranged for Trotsky's death, and that pleased Stalin to such an extent that he spared him, though he did actually hit the buffers a bit later on and ended up in jail. But he was a pretty dark figure. And then there's Motti Eitingen, who ran the biggest fur trading company in the world from New York and pretty much bankrolled the Soviet Union by buying all their furs just after the revolution. And then there is Max Eitingen, who was Sigmund Freud's favorite colleague. And this guy, Max Eitingen, basically bankrolled the early days of psychoanalysis. So it's a family that had huge influence in all sorts of areas. It's a great story.
Wow. Well, tell her we'd be happy to have her come in and talk about that sometime.
Yes, absolutely.
When the airliners are running correctly. Are there any new features or changes coming to the review, to the business model in the near future?
Well, I suppose the most recent thing we've done is tentatively to try and run a blog on our website. This is improving. I mean, I think it's an interesting blog. We haven't perhaps got it quite right yet, but we are working on improving that. And I guess that's the most recent thing in terms of content. I don't think we have anything more in line just at the moment for actually changing the form and content of the thing, but these will come. I think more importantly at this stage is we have to get our heads around how to market the website, how to get an equivalent business model to the kind of thing we've had for the print business, you know, a lifetime value model and all this kind of stuff.
A blog is kind of the antithesis of the London Review of Books, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's a really good point. This is a really good point. I mean, this is a little bit of a quandary. It's a challenge for us. I mean, the London Review of Books is a magazine that is very, very carefully written, very, very heavily edited. You know, these articles take a lot of painstaking work. They're the opposite of the sort of free, improvisatory expression of a blog. And it's short. Well, the shortness is almost not so much the difference as the fact that you're basically writing quickly. You're not spending hours thinking about every sentence. You're not editing it closely. I mean, these are, to some extent, edited blog entries. But, you know, it's a freer form. It's a much more extemporary, a much more speculative form. And our writers have to get used to doing that, I think. But it is different. You're completely right. And, you know, that's a challenge.
Well, folks, listen, you can, I believe, find the London Review of Books in great bookstores almost anywhere, or you can also subscribe to it online at mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com, and of course, you can sample the product, again, online at www.lrb.co.uk. And Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us at Mr. Media today.
No, it's been a pleasure, Bob. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And please take advantage of this great offer from Mr. Media Radio listeners. You can go to www.audiblepodcast.com/mrmedia to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Again, that's www.audiblepodcast.com/mrmedia for your free audiobook. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen, even in London, with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. And you can follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman or facebook.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give a piece of your day to come spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.